was true. On this subject, Radio News 4 deeply reported all the speeches given at the state conference, and in order to publicize them, they have been produced and are available online to facilitate their use for podcasts, community radios, and broadcasters which specialize in pacifism. We sincerely hope that this undertaking serves to focus on the most important area in the world against war and for peace, the elimination of nuclear weapons. Now, I would like to listen to nuclear policy concepts and self-defense, speech delivered by Robert Green on July 6, 2006, at the Conference of Freedom from Nuclear Weapons, from the Royal Academy of Ukraine. Robert Green is a retired commander of the Royal Navy and former chair of the World Court prior to the Ukraine.
My next speaker is Rob Green, whom I think all of you are acquainted with. Rob, as you know, served in the British Royal Navy from 1962 to 1982. He was in anti-submarine helicopters equipped with nuclear depth bombs. On promotion to commander, he spent 2 or 3 years in the Ministry of Defense as personal staff officer to the Assistant Chief of Naval Staff. Rob has left the Royal Navy and has taken voluntary redundancy. He was released after the Falklands War. He is former chair of the World Court Project in the United Kingdom and is now happily married to Kate Dews, lives in Christchurch, and works with Kate and her organization in nuclear disarmament. Rob.
Thank you, Ron. Well, I'm actually in a very interesting position, I think, now. And I want to, first of all, thank Stephen particularly for accepting George's invitation to come today, because this is something I've been looking forward to for some time. I will try to respond to some of Stephen's points as I go along, but I think it'll probably be better if we have it out of discussion. Peter exposed the fragilities of self-defense. Nuclear deterrence is what I want to talk about, and I'm glad that Stephen has addressed that. Its relationship to self-defense, of course, you could say by its proponents, that it underpins self-defense. For those who accuse the International Court of Justice of not addressing nuclear deterrence, I think I must speak on behalf of Judge Wirimantri, who could never be accused of not addressing nuclear deterrence head-on in over 80 pages of his dissenting opinion. And I will have something more to say about how the rest of the court handled it. But I'd like to just start with a proposition that nuclear deterrence is, in fact, state-sponsored nuclear terrorism. And I think this is very relevant to the current so-called war on terror. Professor Richard Falk was uncompromising. I quote, "Nuclear weaponry and strategy represent terrorist logic on the grandest scale imaginable," unquote. So I contend that all the nuclear weapon states are vulnerable to the charge of hypocrisy. And incidentally, the Oxford English Dictionary defines terrorist, it is there, as, quote, "anyone who attempts to further his views by a system of coercive intimidation," unquote. Nuclear deterrence entails a fundamental moral deception. Threatening the most indiscriminate violence possible, unrestrained by morality or the law, to achieve what nuclear-armed state governments claim are the highest moral ends. It is also the antithesis of maintaining international peace and security. That is why I would argue that state-sponsored nuclear terrorism must be rejected and outlawed. We all know to live by threats and menaces is evil. One analogy for nuclear deterrence is that neighbours have amassed enough high explosive laced with anthrax to blow up each other, plus the whole neighbourhood, and make it uninhabitable for years. Another intrinsic, inescapable part of nuclear deterrence dogma is the generation of hostility and mistrust. By inhibiting cooperation in promoting true security, nuclear deterrence tends to be self-perpetuating. So this adds another layer of deception, which deepens the immorality. Its immorality can be seen in hypocritical attempts to pretend that something so flagrantly wrong can be accepted as right. A blatant example was using the following benediction for the commissioning of a British Polaris submarine. I quote, "Go forth into the world in peace, be of good courage, hold fast that which is good, render no man evil for evil, honour all men, love and serve the Lord, rejoicing in the power of the Holy Spirit." Unquote. By contrast, the Royal Navy Ship Names Committee, I believe, may have been unusually perceptive when they named the last UK Polaris submarine HMS Revenge and the last Trident submarine HMS Vengeance. And, of course, the hypocrisy deepened in March 2002 when the British Secretary of State for Defence stated that, like the United States, the British government was prepared to use nuclear weapons if British forces were threatened by chemical or biological weapon attack anywhere in the world, not just in extreme self-defense. And France, of course, recently followed suit. I could go on in more detail into that hypocrisy. But, of course, the double standards here are staggering, not least that part of the American strategy now to combat weapons of mass destruction, echoed by the British and the French, is to use its own, risking provoking opponents to use theirs too, or redouble efforts to get some. Moreover, the preemption doctrine in this form violates the principle of proportionality, as we have heard. I believe there is an interesting parallel here with slavery. You may or may not know that the campaign to abolish slavery began in Britain in 1785, when slavery was accepted in much the same way as nuclear weapons now are, by the establishments of a small group of predominantly Western states and their allies. And of course, three of the leading slaving states are now the leading guardians of nuclear deterrence dogma: the United States, United Kingdom, and France. And of course, pro-nuclear advocates use the pro-slavery arguments. They are a necessary evil, cost-effective, not against the law, and anyway, there is no alternative. They were outmaneuvered by a small group of committed anti-slavery abolitionists who surprisingly focused on the illegality, not just the cruelty, of slavery. And for the first time, the law and public opinion were harnessed on a human rights issue. And this is what forced British politicians to vote against the system which at that time underpinned their wealth. I would now like to just refer specifically to Stephen's criticism of the court, the World Court, for not addressing nuclear deterrence. We all know here that in its advisory opinion, we understand that the court wished to avoid a direct conflict with the five recognized nuclear weapon states, all of which subscribe to nuclear deterrence policies. It therefore decided not to comment specifically on the legal status of nuclear deterrence. This could have been linked to pressure. For example, at the oral proceedings in the case in 1995, the French delegate warned against any pronouncement which directly or indirectly might imply judgment being passed on a defense policy based on deterrence. The British echoed the Americans when they said, "To call in question now the legal basis of the system of deterrence on which so many states have relied for so long for the protection of their peoples could have a profoundly destabilizing effect." Unquote. Now, Stephen and I have had a very interesting correspondence going on, rather publicly, in one of the top defence journals in Britain recently. This is the RUSI Defence Systems. And we actually had a special page devoted to our exchange back in March, April. And I'd just like to read or paraphrase my response to his criticism. He cited the American judge, Schwebel, in support. Yet Schwebel's main argument was that because nuclear deterrence apparently worked in the 1991 Gulf War, a highly contentious claim, it was justified in law. This revealed for me an unacceptable attitude for a supposedly impartial judge, whereby he had allowed his evidently pro-nuclear views to take precedence over the law. No doubt for this reason, his was not a majority ICJ view. Despite such pressures, the court did not shrink from stating in paragraph 36 of its main opinion that it took account of the unique characteristics of nuclear weapons, and in particular their destructive capacity, their capacity to cause untold human suffering, and their ability to cause damage to generations to come. And the next paragraph reads, "The court will now address the question of the legality or illegality of recourse to nuclear weapons in light of the provisions of the UN Charter relating to the threat or use of force." The subsequent discussion was clearly about nuclear deterrence, as in the following extract. "In short, if it is to be lawful, the declared readiness of a state to use force must be a use of force that is in conformity with the Charter. For the rest, no state, whether or not it defended the policy of deterrence, suggested to the court that it would be lawful to threaten to use force if the use of force contemplated would be illegal." Unquote. The court then determined unanimously that any threat or use of nuclear weapons must conform to international humanitarian law, of which the Nuremberg principles are a part. It also confirmed that the principles of the law of armed conflict apply to nuclear weapons. And then in paragraph 95, it concluded, quote, "In view of the unique characteristics of nuclear weapons, the use of such weapons, in fact, seems scarcely reconcilable with such requirements." There is no scenario where the use of even a single 100-kiloton UK Trident warhead, 8 times the explosive power of the Hiroshima bomb, could be lawful. Therefore, I contend, the court actually quite cleverly affirmed the general illegality of the fundamental practice which constitutes nuclear deterrence, while offering a face-saving way for the nuclear weapon states to extract themselves from a policy upon which they remain needlessly impaled. I think I'll just draw my comments to a conclusion by speaking up for one of the women in the audience, namely Angie Zelter, who I know cannot be accused of avoiding debate on this issue. And I have actually helped her several occasions to try to get a debate going with Prime Minister Blair and his government. I would also draw attention to another member of the audience, Lord Ronald Murray, former Solicitor General for the government, British Labour government, back in the 70s, who has helped us a lot about countering some of the ideas from the Scottish High Court. And maybe I would just end. We are hearing, and I think I am in agreement, thoroughly in agreement with Stephen, that the nature of conflict is indeed shifting, and human rights law is coming of age. 3 of the leading proponents of slavery failed to stop the abolitionists. This was because courageous, ordinary British, American, and French citizens mobilized unstoppable public and political support for their campaign to replace slavery with more humane, lawful, and effective ways to create wealth. The analogy, I contend, holds for nuclear deterrence, which can and must be discarded for more humane, lawful, and safer security strategies if civilization and the Earth's ecosystems are to survive. Thank you.
Radio Esports Studio.